According to the Pythagoreans, no natural energy ever broke its own law or tried to. Because in the world of energy, laws or powers are inevitable. It is only in a sphere of individualized intellectual entity that even the concept of disobedience is possible. All disobedience is a limited condition, however, for disobedience can never actually achieve magnitude in itself. For things moving according to their own natures are considered lawful. And in this concept of law, we also have the recognition that the divine law, as a manifestation of the divine will, constitutes the secondary definition of good. Therefore, good and God are of the same origin in the old Anglo-Saxon. And good is that state of a thing existing according to itself. This is perhaps a mysterious statement, but when we say a thing existing according to itself, we mean without conflict with its own essential nature. The universe exists without conflict. It is. Therefore, it is good. It therefore has no possibility of being amended. And no matter what we conceive or how we think or what we believe, we cannot be better than that natural good which is. Man can achieve unity with good, but he cannot surpass it inasmuch as good is perfect order, and no thing can be more than perfect. The will of deity in law and order is thus manifested most perfectly in the great process of creation. So creation is the unfoldment of the great flower of law. And within this flower, enthroned as the Buddhic figure within the cosmic lotus, is the lawmaker, forever throned upon the magnitude of its own manifestation. It is also called the symbol of the creative number, because it is through law and the works of law that the Creator is most evident to the creation. That which has observed the creation has seen the Creator in his work. Though the reason why the number 7 is also associated with rest or with equilibrium is because equilibrium in itself is the secret of the law. The equilibrium of the universe is its primary law, and its extension from this into manifestation gives us the Pythagorean formula of the unmoved mover. The 6 directions are the motions of number. The 7th direction, so-called, is the center, and this is the unmoved point of motion. Law is therefore the unmoved, moving in its 6 inevitable directions. This is law because there are no other directions. Therefore, beyond law and beyond lawfulness, there is nothing. It is impossible for law to escape from law, because law fills all of law. There is no place for the lawful to escape to. And therefore, the number is said to represent that the law keeps itself, and therefore is the perfect example of lawfulness. There is also the interesting and mysterious idea of this central point of equilibrium, or the unmoved. Law exists only as a result of the motions of being. Therefore, if the motion of being ceases, and all things created return again to the root, law is said to sleep. Law rests because it cannot exist apart from manifestation. Law is motion and things unmoved. Therefore, alone transcend law. And the central point of transcendence represents also the point of synthesis. God in its own nature is one. God in manifestation is fixed. God, the nature, plus the manifestation equals seven, which is the exhaustion of the creative power of number. Now, I hope that that is clear. Anyway, we must now go on to the next symbol, which is the Ogdoad, or the eight. Now, the eight was conceived by the Pythagoreans to represent the striving of the two serpents that were twisted around the caduceus of Hermes. But the eight is also the peculiar psychical motion of the magnetic pole of the earth. It is therefore a curious, endless band which crosses itself in the middle and goes on and on. In the tarot cards, it is represented by the strange tilted brim of the hat of the juggler. It is the symbol of continuous, unbroken motion. Therefore, we are not surprised to find the Pythagorean keyword for the number eight is love. Now, we wonder why it should be so decided or so considered. So let us analyze for a moment the concept of the number eight, which is an endless band turned upon itself. It is not merely the serpent with a tail in its mouth, the symbol of eternity. It is a symbol composed of two apparent circles formed by one circle. So let us see why the number eight was so represented by the Greeks. Of course, the number eight is a number which, if divided, gives us two fours, which if in turn divided, gives us two twos, which if in turn divided, gives us two ones. Therefore, the number eight is called a number reducible to unity, because it is susceptible of an equal division into ones, which many numbers are not. The three, for example, cannot be divided equally into ones, unless you want to say three ones. But when you divide it, you do not get unity. You get a one and a two. But in the number eight, you have a complete division. A half of eight is four. A fourth of eight is two. An eighth of eight is one. Four plus two plus one equals seven. Therefore, we find the reestablishment of the law, and we suddenly discover that we have a septenary concealed within the eight, and which the eight exceeds. We also recognize the eight as a number, two out of three of the divisions of which give us even numbers. because the half is 4 and the fourth is 2. Both of these are passive numbers. But the final division restores the sacred number, the uneven number, 1. Now, what has all this got to do with love? That is a rather tricky and technical question. So the Pythagoreans began to study the nature of love in an effort to observe its function in the universal law. And in the course of their discovery, they either discovered or were told, or in one way found out that the number 8 was the great secret number of the Eleusinian mysteries, the number of the great mother of mysteries, the number of Isis and Diana, the great goddess of the Athenians. Thus, the number 8 to them represented concord. It represented not a union of forms, as in the case of the number 6, which is a union of 2 triangles, but a union of infinities, because it is a union of 2 spheres, or circles. The circle being a symptom or symbol of infinity, or an infinite number of parts. Therefore, the union of infinite becomes much more significant and important numerically than the union of forms, bodies, or forces. The number 8 begins to represent then what the Platonists later described as the 8 forms of amity. And we find the Greeks in their own legislative system represented or recognized 8 forms of relationship between things. And these 8 forms to them all represented kinds of regard, affection, or love. Things which are outwardly divided by form cannot outwardly coalesce. Therefore, in order that any forms of themselves integrated and separated can unite, a binder must be introduced of some kind. And in alchemy, this binder was mercury, the universal solvent. Gold and silver could not meet except that both be dissolved in mercury. Everywhere in nature, there has to be a universal solvent by means of which things not naturally, materially compatible can still be brought to identity or to a relative degree of union. To the Greeks, the universal solvent was love. They recognized it as that power which could alone hold things together, which had not yet the power to hold themselves together. If man, for example, could experience identity with another creature and could know himself and that other creature to be one, we would have an entirely different concept of relationship. Christ said, "I and my Father are one." Man can say this, but he cannot experience it. He cannot know it. Therefore, where the individual may not know that he is God, the religious systems of the world tell him, therefore, to love God, and that through the love which he bestows upon God, he builds a bridge between God and himself. And in life, for man, the union of divided parts is through the bridge of human regard, affection, and respect. Now the 8 is composed of 2 fours. And we have already recognized from our study of the four, or the tetrad, that the four represents the divine power involved in the creative process. In other words, the Lord of the material world. And also that part of man which is involved in the psychic mystery of generation. A four may likewise then be considered equivalent to the human psyche in the sense that it represents the demiurgus or secondary creator. For as the universe creates the soul, so the soul in turn engenders the body, fashions it, forms it, and molds it into the likeness of itself. Therefore, an ensouled body, whether it be the solar system or a minute atom, all ensouled bodies are tetrads, because four is also the least number of surfaces that can enclose an area. Thus, any human being is a tetrad, a body and soul. The Ogdoad becoming the symbol of two ensouled bodies, therefore becomes the number of sympathy. Inasmuch as two ensouled bodies have all essential qualities in likeness or in similarity, all creatures, we will say then, are ensouled bodies. Yet having this great identity of fact in common, they cannot get along. They cannot recognize that in all essentials they are one, and that what we call diversity is entirely of matters not essential, or essentially real. Yet by diversity we are infinitely separate, and this separation, or self-centeredness of being, would ultimately lead to the final destruction. For all things, to the degree that they become isolated, separate themselves from the common energies of their kind and perish. Man, therefore, from the beginning, has been afraid of isolation. He has striven in every way possible to create bridges between himself and others. Not only that he may understand, but that he may be understood, both processes being equally important to him. The Ogdoad, then, represents two creations of a similar essential nature, which have been brought together and bound by an endless circuit of energy, forming the mysterious number 8 in form. Thus, the 8 is the symbol of those overtones of regard, those subtle energies of consciousness by which the individual seeks to perfect self through the experience of association, and also attempts to escape from that isolation which means the inability of the self to function. The Greeks recognized that man's selfless has two essential functions. One is the expression of itself through its own organism. And the second is the extension of that expression of self to the circumference of society. In other words, the person not only wishes, in a sense, to control himself, but he wishes to control others. He wishes to extend his psychic field beyond the circumference of his own body. He wishes to exert influence, which moving from him permeates other things, changing them, altering them, modifying them, influencing, controlling them, becomes the basis of conflict. For conflict is not a struggle of bodies, but a struggle of psyches moving through bodies and moving out to the degree that they become inhibiting upon each other. And therefore, we have the battles of wits and of minds, and the struggles of ambition and things of this nature. Eight, because it is a balanced number, because it is an ordered number, indicates a natural and placid association. It is also a passive number, or a negative number, which would imply and infer, therefore, that the virtues which it represents are not virtues of aggression, but virtues of receptivity. Therefore, we say that love seeks not for itself, but for others, and is not a force moving primarily toward self, but from self. And as we study along in psychology and human relationships, we find the individual who loves himself seldom finds any satisfaction in the emotion. To the degree that we center our regards upon ourselves, we are impoverished. To the degree that we bestow them, we enrich ourselves. Passive numbers, therefore, represent indirect methods and would be appropriate to a term like happiness, which can never be the result of a particular effort, but must be the consequence or reaction of things. Therefore, love is a reactive power, the individual growing by what he gives and not by what he has. Love to the philosophical group in the Greek problem represents many levels of affection, extending from friendship through various types of personal regard, through various divisions of affection, as the love of child for parent, the love of parent for child, the love of man for country, the love of man and woman, the love of beauty, the love of virtue, the love of good, the love of truth, the love of wisdom, the love of God. These are all degrees of affection. And strangely enough, all affections of this kind are distantly, but inevitably, possessive. That which we love, we instinctively possess, and only lose when we become aware of our possessiveness. We continue to possess until we say so. Then we lose. We continue to possess until we demand. And then we destroy, because the number is passive. It cannot do in the form of a direct action. A man can earn wisdom, but he cannot carefully plan a career toward love. The Greeks, therefore, agree with most other systems that the term love is essentially undefinable. To define it is to defile it. To rationalize it is to destroy it. It represents an intangible and is the presence of a strange and elusive God, according to the Greeks, who appears and disappears at will, takes innumerable forms, and yet wherever he appears, bestows great goodness, beauty, and glory. For to the Greeks, the God of love was also the inspirer of art, the perfecter of philosophy, and the greatest cause of civilization the world can possibly imagine. It was also the number of initiation into the Eleusinian mysteries, because in these mysteries, man approaches the experience of the love of pure truth. And the mysteries were institutions of love, inasmuch as the purpose of growth is to learn to love reality. Not merely to understand, but with an ardor of the spirit, to cast oneself towards the object of affection. In the Song of Solomon the King, therefore, we find the three great divisions of love, as it was sung also in the mystic songs of the troubadours and the minstrels, and is to be found in the raptures of the dervishes and the Sufis and other Eastern mystics. Solomon says in the beginning of the song, "My beloved is mine." In the middle part of the great song, he says, "My beloved is mine, and I am my beloved." In the last high note of the song, he cries out, "I am my beloved." Emotion from selfishness to unselfishness. And this, according to the Greeks, was the great motion by which things separated outwardly can still find union and can experience above the illusion of separation. So the eighth is a binding of things by their principles and by their essences. And from such bindings also are generations produced, because the productions of love are beauty, and beauty is a great goddess that cannot die. So the next number that we consider is the Aeneas, or the power of the number 9, or the inverted 6. Now, in the Pythagorean system, the number 9 is called the number of limitations. Now, there are many reasons why it is so designated. For one thing, as is rather obvious, that the 9 immediately falls short of the 10, which is the complete cycle of number. Therefore, it means to fall short. 9 is the number of man, because it is the number of the generative cycle of 9 months, which was recognized by the ancients. In other words, the prenatal epic of man, it consists of 9 symbolic months. And also, in the same Eleusinian and Sabbatian rites among the Greeks, the lesser mysteries, or the degrees of the lesser rites, were 9 in number, to represent the human being in his prenatal existence. Man, therefore, is a creature who has fallen short. And in the ancient language, if we go back into the root of words, the word that we call sin means to fall short. Sin does not mean primarily an act of violence against God. It means, in some way, to fall short of sufficiency. The sinner, therefore, is the imperfect one, that which has not yet achieved consummation. Therefore, to be born in sin and conceived in iniquity meant originally nothing more than to be born imperfect. The rest of it was a little theological dressing to make it sound more formidable. But man falls short. And there are many symbolisms explaining this falling short. The human being exists within the womb of nature, which is symbolized in ancient times for the zodiac. The zodiac at one time consisted of 10 signs of 36 degrees each. Later, the compound sign of Virgo Scorpio was broken and the sign of Libra or equilibrium was placed between. We still find the trace of this in the similarity of the form of the two signs, Virgo and Scorpio, and also in the setting up of the scales of Amenthet in Libra, part of the old mystery ritual of the balance, equilibrium between the two great arcs of the universe. But in the Greek system, The concept of the 12 divisions of the zodiac was also known at the time of Pythagoras and generally accepted. And we find that man is therefore 9/12 of a circle. He requires for his prenatal epoch 9/12 of a year. And as he lies in embryo form, his body occupies 9/12 of a circle. In the same way, the Greeks believed that the human brain is 9/12 of a sphere. All these symbolisms, well, they may or may not be sustained historically, or we will say physiologically, are still of interest to us. So what do we find? That from a very early time, there were three steps or degrees of the state mystery introduced to make possible the complete birth of man. In the ancient wisdom teachings, therefore, man is born by 9 months of generation and 3 degrees of initiation. The broken wheel being mended by the ritual or rite. For the silver cord is loosened and the wheel is broken at the piston. The broken wheel, which occurs very often in early religious symbolism, is this symbol of imperfection, the incomplete being. The 9/12 creature. Now, number 9 is also the symbol of limitation, because according to the Greeks, imperfection exists throughout matter, and the created universe, which is the archetype for man, man being the microcosm, the world being the macrocosm, is also itself 9/12. Of creation, or of a creative power. The Pythagoreans recognized this also by establishing 9 levels or layers of the mundane world. They recognized, after the Egyptians, the universe or solar system or world, they used these terms rather interchangeably in those days, as symbolized by the cross-section of an onion with its concentric circles, one inside of the other. And in this cross-sectioning, which is incidentally the same concept of the universe that appears in Dante and in Milton, the layers are 9 in number, the lowest of them being the earth, above which are the 7 orbits of the planet, making 8, and then the 9th, which is the sphere of the fixed stars, being a circle surrounding the rest. Therefore, according to Plato, souls coming into generation fell from the sphere of the fixed stars, descended through the orbits of the planets, and finally entered the earth, or the crator, the cup, the vessel which receives these things. Man is therefore represented by them as 8 plus 1, or 9. 8 being the symbol of principles, and the 9th of the depository, or cup, the crator, which receives principles, being the physical form or body. Man is therefore 8-fold in his complete superphysical construction. And to this is ended or added body, which is the receptacle of principles, but is not itself a principle. Man thus combined or formed together is the symbol of this imperfect pattern, this unbalanced structure, this wheel which cannot turn and cannot support the load for which it was intended. The wheel, incidentally, was not only by the Greeks, but also by the Mayas and Aztecs of Central America, regarded as a symbol of imperfection. And no wheeled vehicle was used in America prior to the coming of the Spaniards. They considered it a symbol of ill luck or of evil. They declared that when the wheel came, civilization would die. Well, we've got a few wheels around here. I don't know whether it has brought about the problem that we know, but wheels within wheels can be dangerous. The nine is a symbol of man because it was also associated with a positive pole of generation. Man not only has these nine tenths or nine twelfths of a completeness, but according to the ancients, he had nine bodily orifices, he had nine essential systems of bodily structure, and throughout all of his development, there was a repetition of the cycle of nine. The combination of nine and six equals the sign of Cancer, by the way, which is the symbol of generation in the zodiac. Man, therefore, represents a generating power which lacks the completeness or the fullness of regenerative capacity. Man as nine must therefore be subject to salvation because in some way he is imperfect. The Chinese carry this symbolism to quite a degree because whenever they produce a work of art, they intentionally make a flaw so that it shall not be said that they aspire to the perfection which peculiarly belongs to heaven. And when the Japanese painter and sculptor Kobo Daishi, one of the founders of the great Shingonshu, one of the great divisions of Buddhism in Japan, was making the dragons on the top of the gate of a temple. He did so beautifully that when he put the last drop of paint exactly where it belonged, the dragons began to move. He was so perfect that he had bestowed life, and therefore with the quickness of mind for which he was always justly distinguished, he took a little paint of the wrong color and put it on, and immediately the dragons returned to wood again. A nice symbolism, but implying or suggesting this idea that man, were he complete, would indeed be a god. And that the universe could, so to say, come completely to life in him. But there is something lacking, something mysterious, like the mysterious ingredient for the philosopher's stone, which the alchemist sought everywhere but could never find. And this imperfection is the key to humanity, and therefore the number nine, which incidentally also was an important number because it contained three triads. And these three triads were themselves symbolic of the nature of man, who has a threefold spiritual nature, a threefold psychic nature, and a threefold body. Thus he has everything except the cord to string them together with, and that remains until another number. Man has all the faculties, but he is now struggling desperately for the establishment of that which is missing, and that is what the modern psychologist likes to term integration, oneness, to bind them together. Man is still a creature divided, because his nine needs the one to make it a unit, to make it a oneness again. So we are not surprised then that the decad, or the number 10, is called by Pythagoras what? Faith. And that is only one of the names, however, which he gave it. Not faith, faith. F-A-I-T-H. Because it is the object of all human sincere contemplation. The decad is called the triumph of number. It is number which, having moved from unity through diversity, establishes a new kind of integration. It is the achievement of the unity of totality, for the ten becomes the symbol of the whole tetraxis, or the sum of number. As the one is a symbol of indivisible unity, the ten is the symbol of attained unity. The final consummation of all things in the perfection of themselves is ten. Because to the Pythagoreans, ten equals perfection, which in turn equals unity. For in their thinking, all things to be perfect must be established in a state of indivisible oneness. A perfect mind must be absolutely unified. A perfect society must be a perfect unit. Everything must be a unit. And by unity, not a compelled unit, but an attained unit. The ten, therefore, is the voluntary association of numbers and their consummation in the reestablishment of a concept of totality. Now, how does man at this stage think this through? How is he to envision a totality which he cannot experience? Every human being, nearly, is looking toward something more than he is. He is seeking peace, security, happiness, sufficiency. All of these things are different from the one, inasmuch as they are achieved unities, or the cycle of the one, passing through diversity and reaffirming itself. So the cipher becomes a symbol of the cycle, or the motion by means of which things return to themselves. But the addition of the cipher to the unit makes this unit the appropriate archetypal form for the tetraxis, or the ten dots. For it is the sum of all number, and any number absent results in the loss of the ten. Nor can there be any essential number above the ten. For ten, says Pythagoras, exhausts the diversity of number. As man, through the experience of living, exhausts the diversity of experience. And when you have experienced everything, what have you? Unity. There is nothing else you can have. When you know everything, you know one thing. Because everything is merely a phase of one thing. There are not ten wisdoms in the world. There is one wisdom with ten ways of reaching it. But no matter how you travel, no matter what you learn, you can only exhaust diversity. And when you have realized that, you have achieved the consciousness of absolute unity. So unity in the sense of ten is the exhaustion of all numbers. And the numbers are like, in the old legend, are represented by rivers which, flowing down, all meet in the number ten, which represents the sea. And the number ten, of course, is a potential one, because the sun will raise the water from the sea, carry it in the clouds, drop it on the mountains, where it will become many streams, and will finally come back and converge again into the sea. So the journey from the sea to the sea is the journey from the one to the ten. And it is infinitely repeated. But Plotinus calls it the journey of that which is alone, the one, to that which is alone is, the sea. The drop of water and the sea are both unity. So the number ten, having fulfilled all things, is considered the archetypal number, of course, of adeptship, or of the perfection of everything that can be perfected or achieved by man. In every department of life, the ten is the beginning plus the method or the means or the intervals, and the end, which is in the beginning. And in the great Egyptian glyph of Raphael-Nilus, this is the serpent with the tail in his mouth. Because all things are moving in this eternal cycle. Thus Pythagoras, affirming the basis of his entire mathematical system, also established for us the concept of the decimal system, by which all things are measured in terms of ten. And in this basic concept, we think, we do not know, that perhaps mankind developed the idea from the ten fingers, which he first used in counting. And there is the old story, you know, that when he had to get to 11, he had to take a shoe off. There was the concept of the ten, and the ten in the Kabbalah, of course, was composed of two fives, which were the hands. The placing of the hands in certain Jewish rituals represents the union of these two fives, which in turn represents the two tablets of the law, each containing five of the commandments. So the ten commandments, which constitute the law and the prophets, is another statement of the completeness or fulfillment of universal laws in the Decad. And the Decad was completed originally by the old legend, inasmuch as the inscription on one tablet of the law was raised, and the inscription on the other tablet of the law was engraved into the tablet, so that when the two tablets met, the raised and the sunken part united, forming one absolutely solid pattern. This, of course, represented the union of the positive and negative principles, or the polarized concepts of law and order, or law and the prophet, or the old and the new dispensation, and all that has to do with it. Now, the addition of 1 to 9 equals the 10. Therefore, the number one added to the nine becomes also a messianic symbol and is so represented in nearly all religious systems. Because there appears the intercessor, the comforter, the sotar, the messiah, who in each life plays the part of the one to make the nine ten. He is available, or this power is forever supplementing the nine to make the ten. And is so recognized in the Jewish metaphysical system and also in the Christian Kabbalah of the Middle Ages. The ten, then, we have now as the symbol of the completeness, of the wholeness or the fullness of a thing. The numbers have fulfilled their part, they have been added together, and out of the addition of the first four numbers is restored the number one again. Because the number one is the first part of the ten. Now the Pythagoreans and other numerologists after them have taken another attitude. Namely that you take your compound numbers, for example, and you add these numbers to find again your basic unity, according to the gematria and the notaricum of the Kabbalists. Thus, for instance, if you have a number 25, you take the 2, add it to the 5, and you have 7, and you go back to your basic pattern again. So all numbers above 10 are reducible to numbers under 10. The general exception in some systems is that 2 numbers, 11 and 22, are not reduced. These have to do with certain key letters of the Jewish alphabet. But it is normal, for instance, to take a number above 10 and add the parts of it to produce another number. Thus, 34 you add together, you have 7. 29 becomes 11. And that number you do not reduce, but leave it 11. Thus, in all these systems, you have some rather interesting problems that appear. Now, when we come to the study of certain numbers, we find other habits about them that are interesting. The number 5, multiplied by itself, will always have itself as in the final term of the multiplication. 5 fives are 25. And any of them, this number, or the number 6 multiplied by itself, will always have the number 6. 6 sixes are 36, and the number is returned, or is recurrent. Now, by this process, what do we have? We have here 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 plus 7 plus 8 plus 9 plus 10. And if you add them all together, you get 55, and add those, you get 10 again. 5 and 5 equal 10. And so you go. And you find these numbers are infinitely repeating formulas. And these formulas are the things that to the Pythagoreans reveal the infinite power of number. Now there is one use which they all made, and which we have totally lost, in which they did combine letters and numbers for a certain purpose. Thus, for example, when they wished to conceal an energy, universal power, or agency under a name, they would select for that name one the sum of which, numerically, would be equal to the power intended. This was done by a particular process. Therefore, the Gnostics took the deity Abraxas, which was their god of the cycle, and the Greek number system associated with the letters is such that the numerical power of Abraxas is 365, which is the symbol of the year. They frequently made use of this type of symbolism. Therefore, the number 666, which is associated in Revelation with the beast, is the sum of the numerical value of the Greek word, which means the lower intellect. Thus, they used words and numbers to indicate particular meanings in order that each of these meanings might be meaningful and obvious through a Kabbalah or through a method. Thus, according to Pythagoras, to take the names of any of the Greek deities, take their numerical equivalent, and you can reduce them on the tetractys to the power for which they stand. This is because these names were selected by the ancient Orphics with this purpose in mind. And the Egyptian system upon which it was built was much earlier than Greek civilization, although Pythagoras was the first to publicly describe it. Thus, all, perhaps, of the admonitions that we find in the book of Revelation, for instance, are meaningful. For it calls a particular spiritual penalty upon anyone who shall change the spelling of a single name and no one knows why. But it was because of this analogy between the meanings of letters and of the power of number. Thus, letters were associated with number in this way. But I think you will see that thus, in this application, we are not necessarily dealing with a problem of divination. We are dealing with a cipher by means of which we can substitute letters for numbers, and in that way create words which are appropriate names for things, and yet which do not necessarily have the meaning that we first suspect. This is an excellent manner for making a concealment of some kind, which could go back to the science of numbers. This was used a great deal in the Old Testament, where many names are merely very carefully concealed mathematical formulas. So by these formulas, you get another way of reaching into the mystery involved, or the idea behind the use of certain letters and characters. So in general, that is what we can cover in connection with this concept of number. Those of you who are interested in going further with it, you will find a section in our book on symbolical philosophy devoted to this, and with a fairly complete development of the basic number patterns as recorded by Fiona Smyrna. For those who are intrigued beyond this point in their study of the Pythagorean theory of number, I believe one of the best available texts, although it is a difficult one, and very scarce, it can be consulted here in our library, and that is Higgins' great work, The Anacalyptic. This work shows a great deal of research into Pythagorean number. Many secret societies, incidentally, that survive today have numerical symbols which can be reinterpreted in terms of letters and back and forth. These things become an interesting problem. Dionysius describes the logos, or the great figure, blazing in light with every letter of the Greek alphabet located on some part of its body. And, of course, Pythagoras tells us that his own name, which was not his real name, but the name Pythagoras contains within its numerical and letter powers the entire secret of his doctrine. It was never left in any other form. So this is the philosophy of number. And for those who wish to extend the research, it can be a very intriguing problem.